I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in for today's The Record on KUOW. We're one day away from the presidential inauguration festivities in Washington, D.C., and the inauguration is drawing Donald Trump fans and Donald Trump foes from here in the Pacific Northwest. KUOW's Tom Bonsi says large contingents from our area will be on the National Mall Friday and again on Saturday.
Hundreds of thousands of people are expected to gather around the west front of the U.S. Capitol and spill down the National Mall to see Donald Trump become the nation's 45th president. Monica Wachowiak of Spokane is planning to be there, wearing her red Make America Great Again ball cap. She was proudly sporting that hat at a quirky coffee shop in Spokane before leaving for the other Washington.
Trump is a president, is going to be a president like none other. He broke the mold. I'm excited just to be a part of something so huge, and that's going to make history.
Wachowiak is a 36-year-old tattooed Jewish Republican. She works as a property manager and volunteers on campaigns in her spare time. Her excitement about scoring tickets to the inauguration, three inaugural balls, and finding affordable flight and hotel is tempered a little bit by uncertainty about what crazy stuff might happen.
I kind of know what to expect from being at big events in D.C., like a Darfur rally and things like that, but I'm a little nervous because of everything coming around it with all the protests, the marches.
I located some of the protesters going to Washington, D.C. from the Northwest. Christine Chin Ryan of Sandy, Oregon, made inauguration travel reservations before the November election, thinking that Hillary Clinton would win. Since she had the plane tickets, she decided it was meant for her to go to the National Women's March on Washington on the day after the inauguration and parade.
I want to tell this Trump administration and the Republicans they do not have a mandate when Hillary won by almost 3 million votes.
Chin Ryan is a veteran Democratic activist, 61 years old, and Chinese American.
I'm ready to fight. I'm ready to fight him because I just don't think his policies are going to be good for the United States of America. I'm an immigrant, and this is like the best country in the whole world.
Chin Ryan says a main reason she's going to march is to demonstrate solidarity. The Women's March is shaping up to be the largest of the inauguration protests in D.C. Advance registration is voluntary, so it's hard to say how many marchers will come from the Northwest. Local organizers in Oregon and Washington State estimate hundreds from each state will make the trip east. Meanwhile, members of Congress from Oregon and Washington collectively doled out more than 3,000 free tickets to constituents wishing to attend the Trump swearing-in and inaugural address. Again, Trump fan Monica Wachowiak.
So there's going to be so many protesters there. There's going to be so many supporters there. And are they going to clash? Are they going to be friends?
The marchers I spoke to said they plan to stay away from the swearing-in ceremony, the parade, and inaugural balls. Republican State Senator Doug Erickson of Ferndale, Washington, a Trump supporter, is bringing his whole family to take it all in, including two school-aged daughters.
They've never been to an inauguration before in Washington, D.C. The family hasn't been back there, so it'll be a great learning experience for the kids, for myself, and we're just really excited to be part of history.
A half dozen high schools from Washington and Idaho are sending students for that very reason, too. One event that strives to bring partisans of all stripes together is the Western States inaugural ball on Saturday night. The nonpartisan state societies in Washington, D.C. for Oregon, Washington, Alaska, Montana, and Colorado are co-organizing this ball. But from what I can tell, those in the mood to dance the night away are mostly Republicans, some lobbyists, and Capitol Hill staffers. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
Not only that, but at least 65 Democratic members of Congress are choosing not to attend tomorrow's inauguration. One of those lawmakers is Representative Pramila Jayapal. She's just succeeded Jim McDermott, representing the 7th District. Jayapal says there are a lot of reasons she will not be in D.C. tomorrow.
One is there's an expectation that the other side and President-elect Trump does not have to follow norms and traditions, but somehow everybody else is supposed to. And when I really thought about this and thought about what the inauguration meant and what I should be doing on that day, I felt like I should be right here with my constituents who are actually terrified, and I don't use that word lightly, about their place in this city and in this country. And I felt it was important for me to be here with them. So we're doing a roundtable with immigrant advocates, Dreamers, undocumented immigrants, to really talk about what they're feeling and what the path forward might be. But I also want to say that I had a hard time imagining that I could stand up on the stage and celebrate the inauguration of somebody that I had hoped post-election would transition from being a very divisive candidate to being a unifying president and president-elect. And that has not happened. And we saw it in the way that he responded to John Lewis's announcement that he was not attending the inauguration. I think we should expect and demand much more. And really, in these days, I think what we're looking for is for this soon-to-be president to put to rest some of the questions around both moral and political legitimacy. So,
do you agree with Georgia Congressman John Lewis that Trump is not a legitimate president?
I think that he has a lot of questions that he needs to answer. If he wants to really make sure that everybody does not doubt his legitimacy, I think what he needs to do is release his tax returns, call for an independent investigation of foreign interference in our election. And I think then he also needs to think about the appointments that he is making and not continuing to appoint people who have, frankly, scandals in their backgrounds and, you know, have espoused views that are deeply disturbing to so many people. This is a serious issue, and I think that we're going to have a president who stands to be in violation of the Constitution.
I'm not quite putting words in your mouth, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, but it made news when Congressman Lewis said that Trump is not a legitimate president. And what I hear you saying is that without tax returns and better appointments and an investigation into possible Russian interference, he's not legitimate to you yet.
I think I have not gone as far as Congressman Lewis, and who I have tremendous respect for. I feel like Donald Trump was elected by the Electoral College, as much as some people might have wished for a different outcome. But what I believe is he can't take office with legitimacy in terms of how people see him and the ability for him to be effective. That's what I call moral legitimacy. Unless he shows that he respects the Constitution that he is saying that he's going to protect and uphold. And we're just a couple of days away from the inauguration. He has not turned over his assets. He has not sold off his assets and put the proceeds into a blind trust. In fact, we don't even know what his full range of conflicts of interest might be. And to me, it's very important that we think about the symbolism of that even more than we think about the symbolism of any single person or group of people staying away from the election. But what I think, the fact that there are 60 people now, or over 60 people staying away from the inauguration, what that means is that hopefully it brings some attention to the work that he is going to have to do if he really wants to assume this office of the president with any moral and political authority.
Well, your predecessor in your office, Congressman Jim McDermott, had to make the same decision, and reflecting on whether he should attend George W. Bush's inauguration, he vigorously opposed Bush. McDermott said, quote, "You can disagree with somebody, but the presidency of the United States is an office I'm sworn to uphold and make it work for all Americans." Why do you not feel that you have that obligation as well?
Well, I don't think that this is about disagreeing with viewpoints or perspectives. I have disagreed with many viewpoints and perspectives and still been absolutely in favor of the process that brings people into office. And I still am. But what I do believe is that there are also traditions and norms that are expected of the person who's going to hold the highest office. And I think that this is unprecedented that somebody going into office would start with the level of conflicts of interest that this president has. And that is really where I think we should be focusing, is on the fact that this is, I don't think we've ever seen anything like it. And we can't pretend that the election or the level of three intelligence agencies coming together to say that there is proof that there was foreign interference in our election, or the fact that this president has, the president-elect has refused to release any of his tax returns. None of that is normal, and we can't normalize it.
We've been talking with U.S. Representative Pramila Jayapal, who will be in her district in Seattle instead of at this Friday's inauguration of Donald J. Trump. And if the next president is a Democrat, Congresswoman, will you care how many Republican Congress members show up at that inauguration?
I really don't in so many ways. I really think it's up to each person to decide how to best discharge their duties as a Congress member. And for me, I think that paying attention to my constituents, being here for them, helping to forge a path forward, making sure I'm representing their interests is incredibly important. And so I'm honored that I'm going to be able to be here. I wish it were different. I wish we were not put in a situation by this president-elect to have to choose, frankly.
Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, representing Seattle, Edmonds, Burien, and Moore in the 7th District. Also skipping the inauguration, Congressman Adam Smith in the 9th. Tacoma, Bellevue, parts of Seattle. And speaking of skipping inauguration events, you'll meet a progressive activist who's chosen not to go to Saturday's Women's March in Seattle. She'll tell you why in 20 minutes. Donald Trump's inauguration party begins today with musicians like Toby Keith playing the Lincoln Memorial. This week in the Northwest, there'll also be celebrations, along with demonstrations and other discordant sounds, signs that a new era of protest music is brewing. KUOW's David Hyde reports.
Portland-based musician Kyle Kraft's protest song, Before the Wall, was inspired by this promise.
We will build a great wall along the southern border.
If the wall, it goes up, and the country comes down, and
it's just one big question. What does that wall that's being talked about getting built, what does that represent? You know, what does that represent to not only the people inside of it, but outside of it? I think that's what Trump's message was this, like, we don't need anybody else but us.
Most of Kraft's other songs sound a lot more like David Bowie than Woody Guthrie, and in the past, he's tackled more of the personal than the overtly political. But Kraft says things feel different right now.
This moment is so, it's a cloud, you know, it's hanging over you in the same way that these love experiences and romance experiences sort of hung over my life like a cloud. It feels silly to even have personal problems like that right now.
Other Northwest artists are feeling the same push and pull, like the Seattle band Wimps.
Typically, the songs are just about like whatever happened in one of our days. So it's a lot of daily life stuff, oversleeping or feeling anxious about work, being at a show and realizing you're the oldest person there, like that kind of thing.
Rachel Ratner's the band's lead singer.
Before this election, when I was writing songs about day-to-day minutiae, it was about not wanting to go to work today. And now larger things are taking up my mind, so those minutiae aren't as important to me as like the larger issues that are faced in the world. How I'm going to translate that into song is still being figured out.
Ratner says a lot of Seattle bands are feeling the same political mood right now, and it's not just about the music.
How to make sure immigrants are supported, women are supported, Planned Parenthood and abortion rights are supported. So there's been a lot more benefits I've noticed bands doing. A lot of that kind of like community activism.
Seattle music critic Charles R. Cross says political moments like this one tend to usher in big cultural changes, particularly when you look at the history of popular music.
Having a conservative right-wing government, in my opinion, my own political take, is bad for virtually everything other than old rich white guys. But it seems to be good for music.
And Cross says,
there is almost an absolute direct correlation that every great rock and roll song was written during a right-wing administration.
Seattle feminist punk band Taco Cat have always been political, but lead singer Emily Noakes agrees that this moment is different.
We've had some really angry songs before, but I kind of tend to skew towards humor in writing, and now I am finding it a little hard to even do that. I don't feel funny about any of this right now. Like, I just feel like pissed off, like I want to write an album full of like shrieking harpy noises.
And Noak says when it comes to the Northwest music scene, a change is going to come.
A lot more people are feeling mobilized and feeling like they need to do something about it. Like, it's certainly in my community where people are just like, what do we need to do?
In Seattle, I'm David High, KUOW News.
KUOW's reporting on how the Trump administration might affect this region, and you can join the conversation on our Facebook page. The bands Taco Cat and Wimps will be playing an Inauguration Day benefit show tomorrow night in Seattle at Barboza. Okay, so local musicians protesting in song. But does that mean those songs will be listenable? I asked music journalists Charles Cross and Gina Arnold what makes a great protest song. And Cross said even the term protest song has problems.
I mean, when we think protest song, the word is antiquated. And we're thinking like a bunch of folkies from the 60s who are standing strumming acoustic guitars. And those songs, which were very, very much in the moment, and we're almost even using that term, we're specifically thinking primarily civil rights or Vietnam War song. But I think a great protest song is a song that has a political underpinning that isn't necessarily obvious at first. So in my mind, the best protest songs of all times are songs that, you know, have a political underpinning, but aren't very obvious necessarily.
Why is it better to not be explicit?
Because when it's explicit, then the listener loses the experience of getting lost in the song. Songs work, in my mind, whether they're love songs or whether they're political songs, when the listener gets lost in the singer's voice or in the narrative. You weave your own narrative into the story, or that's my take.
Gina, what's your take on a great protest song?
Well, I agree with Charles utterly with what he just said, but I do think there's such a thing as a protest sound rather than a protest song. We hear protest sound in punk rock. Its entire sort of reversal of what we considered good about music. It was an outcry. It was protesting the social conditions at the time. We hear it in rap music. You know, rap music in its origins in the Bronx, you know, was seizing control of the sound of the city and saying, look at us. This is our experience. And even today, rap music is used in that way to sort of ally yourself with the underclasses. And I do think that, you know, back in the past, there was a sort of sound of folk music, you know, a kind of acoustic guitars, melodies, and it was, as Charles pointed out, really allied to a time where there was a real consensus on the anti-war movement and civil rights. People in America really rallied around those single causes. So a song that comes to mind to me that worked in that way, that was explicit, was Ohio by Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Ten soldiers and Nixon's coming. We're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming. For dead in Ohio. Gotta get down.
That was a song about a single incident that just outraged the nation.
And the National Guard shooting.
Yeah,
for Kent State students.
At Kent State for protesting. And I don't think we can really access the raw shock of that event that everybody in America felt at that time. It was very visceral, and the song spoke to that.
So Ohio, great song. Charles, it didn't violate your don't be explicit rule. I mean, they didn't say Kent State, but four dead in Ohio. That's on the nose.
That is a very explicit song, and it does violate my idea because it is, and the one thing about when I listen to that song now, it does feel really tied to a time where I think the greatest protest songs are not necessarily tied to one moment. I mean, it's an incredible song, and the guitar lick of Ohio is brilliant, but it's also used in movies and other things now as a timestamp. It's a song that feels very much of an era. In my argument, I think one of the greatest, you know, political or protest songs of all time is Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come, which when I listen to it doesn't necessarily feel tied to a particular time.
I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't.
long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
And it doesn't mention one incident. It doesn't mention one particular timestamp.
It might not even seem like a protest song to some people.
To many people, it doesn't. But it's, of course, rooted in Sam Cooke's sense of gospel music. And if we really want to go back to the original protest music, gospel music has some of those roots. It's about changing the perspective of the singer. You are believing in a better time. That's what gospel music really is, and to some degree, that's also what protest music is.
So there's hope. There's also anguish in that. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die.
God. It's an amazing amount of anguish, and, you know, it's about the fear of being an African-American in America, and that fear is very real today in the era of Ferguson and in 2017. So that's one reason I think that song sort of transcends the time it was written in the purpose it was written for.
The music we've heard so far is 45, 50 years old. Were the 60s and 70s the heyday of protest music, and if so, why?
I think yes, in the sort of classic sense of protest song or protest music. I think we mentioned before that they were tied to very real events, the Vietnam War, the anti-war movement, and civil rights, which are two of the biggest social movements of the 20th century in America.
But we have real events today. We have Black Lives Matter and Occupy Wall Street and climate change and wars in the Middle East. There's plenty to talk about, right?
Well, we do, and we have lots of songs that address each of those issues individually. But what we have is a very fragmented audience due to the internet. So unlike those days when people listened to the radio and there was just a sort of set number of songs that you were going to hear that people could rally around, today the internet really turns everybody's playlist into their own personal belief. So they can find the songs that address the issues that they're interested in. But a single unifying song about any single unifying event, I just feel that right now we're too polarized politically in America to rally around any single cause like that.
I think we are polarized, and I think the internet definitely has fragmented music in general. I mean, let's just separate music from protest music, but the capacity of an album to dominate popular culture and be, even you take Beyoncé's album, which was one of the biggest albums of the year, the fragmented part of society that listened to that album is still a very small amount compared to what a Michael Jackson's Thriller or Nirvana, Nevermind, which is 1991. You know, we may never see an album dominate again like some of those albums in the 80s and 90s did.
Well, here's a modern song that was very tied to a specific issue, Same Love by Macklemore in 2012.
Strip away the fear, underneath it's all the same love, about time that we raised up.
I can't sex.
Great protest song or not?
I think it's a great song. And again, it's tied to a specific issue and it has a particular sort of popular music sound that will only appeal to a certain set of music listeners. And I hope it may have changed some of those listeners' minds. But I still can't see that song sort of reaching out to an entire nation.
I somewhat disagree with Gina. It didn't quite become a song that the entire nation went around, but I think it crossed over beyond what the normal audience was for it. For example, they were on the Ellen DeGeneres show, and a mainstream America got exposed to that song in a way that they wouldn't have necessarily if it would have just been a song on a Macklemore album.
Gina, you use the song Formation by Beyoncé as an example to your students of a modern protest song. What is it about Formation?
Formation is a song that can be read in many ways. It's not explicitly political in the ways that I think it was meant. But when you watch the video, it's clearly about Hurricane Katrina and Black Lives Matter. There's a very, very intense scene at the end of the video where a little boy who's meant to represent Tamir Rice holds up his hands and is being shot at by black police officers. It says Black Lives Matter in the back of it, and then he dances. in front of these police. So it's very clear what she meant, as she had her dancers at the Super Bowl dressed as black, in, you know, Black Panther regalia, and it created quite a lot of controversy in the mainstream press.
As you say, formation is different because the controversial or sharp political content, it's a very race-conscious song, but the political content is more in the visuals.
And that's true of many songs today, where the song itself is kind of not really clear what it's about. But once a director or a performer has to decide what to put in the video, the imagery of the video can be very, very political. Maybe it's me, but I don't know of the great protest song of this moment. I'm not aware of what is the song that the nation is embracing. I don't know.
Even though people have been protesting, agonizing for months since the election.
There has not been a song for me that's crystallized the moment. There have been many songs I'm going back to in my own listening, which is Fight the Power and A Change is Going to Come and these other songs that give me hope in a time that, frankly, I feel somewhat hopeless about. That's what music does to you. It takes you away from where you're at and it gives you the sense of a different world, a greater world, whether it's gospel music, whether it's R&B, or whether it's a protest song in the civil rights era.
In conclusion, the protest song, over or not over?
Protest song is over. Not, radio's not allowed to say that. Politically motivated songs or politically content, songs with political content is a much better way to describe what we're talking about. And what we're arguing is that many, many great songs of today have that and have a purpose in life.
The protest song might be over, but the protest sound is still with us, the sound of protest. Jacques Attali said, music is a herald for change. It tolls change for us to hear. And I would like to hear that change ring out.
Gina Arnold is a music critic and professor of social movements at Evergreen State College. And Charles Cross is a Seattle-based music journalist and author.
We don't want your tiny hands anywhere near our underpants. We don't want your tiny hands anywhere near our underpants. We don't want your tiny...
Well, there's a bit of a protest song, kind of. Tiny Hands by Fiona Apple. She wrote that just for this weekend's Women's March in Washington. Maybe they'll play Tiny Hands at the Seattle Women's March. Ijeoma, who knows? You won't know because you're not going to be there.
No, I will not.
This is a progressive writer and activist, Ijeoma Oluo. Good to see you again.
Good to be here.
We're talking about this Saturday's Seattle version of the National Women's March. There might be 50,000 people marching through Seattle on Saturday. The organizers have said that Donald Trump's election has ignited a fire in people, inspiring them to stand up for human rights and get involved in their community. And you were invited to speak at the Seattle March. Ijeoma, why did you say no?
In all honesty, at first, the reason why I said no was I've made a pledge for this year that I will not speak for free, especially to events with budgets, to majority white audiences. It is an emotional and mental effort. There's a lot of anguish involved in talking about oppression and systemic racism in our society. And I view asking women of color to do that for free is exploitative. And a lot of our oppression has been built on the economic exploitation of women of color. And so I gave it a lot of thought, but at the end of the day, it was not something I could do.
Now, listeners might think, wow, she's slamming the Seattle March. I read your Facebook post. You're supportive of the march.
I am. I'm very supportive, and I hope that a lot of people show up.
You have said, though, that some of the marchers have had the privilege to just now decide that something must be done. What makes you say that?
Well, honestly, it's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing it from a lot of people. A lot of people are talking like this is a new renaissance of protest. People are saying our movements are going to be so grand. They're going to be so wonderful. Everyone is out in the streets. And a lot of people who have been out in the streets for a very long time are saying, where are you? Because just because the worst is happening to you now doesn't mean the worst hasn't already come for plenty of people in America, for women of color, for people of color, for trans people, for disabled people. The worst has been here for a long time. So I feel like a lot of that view is simply that you just didn't see everyone who's been fighting for a very long time.
And you also said that the newcomers should not expect to build their movements on the backs of those who have been fighting. Is that Is that happening to you? Is a movement being built on your back, the back of other people of color?
Yes, I would say that the requests that I've gotten to work for free, to speak for free, to write for free have probably tripled since this election. A lot of people want me to come in and basically redo the work that I've already been doing and the work that a lot of other women of color have already been doing for their benefit, because they're just now paying attention. And that ignores, you know, really what oppression is. And a lot of oppression is expecting people of color to come in and work for you uncompensated.
Well, the organizers say that this march, it's inclusive. Many of the organizers are women of color. Many of the speakers are women of color. They've reached out to a lot of groups. What else do you want them to do for this march?
Yes, and I do...
Besides pay.
I applaud those efforts. But what I'm hearing, and it's not just me, I've also heard from people who, women of color, who were asked to donate venues at reduced cost and free, and other vendors of color. And we really do have to look at, if we want to fight oppression, what is actually causing oppression. And economic oppression is one of the primary pillars holding up, you know, racial oppression in this country. And we simply cannot ignore that. I think that what we need to be doing is really looking at, if we say we are marching for people of color, we're marching for women, we are marching for trans people, we are marching for disabled people, we need to actually march for the things that will help them, and that means listening to them. Not just saying we have these many brown faces and black faces in the audience. We actually have to look at what people are marching for.
It's hard for white people not to take comments like this personally, Ijeoma, as you well know. Are you sure, though, that you're not stereotyping and minimizing thousands of marchers who you don't even know?
No, I'm not saying anything about people's intent. Right. And honestly, I've said many times, intent means very little to me. I do hope that people go and they have a wonderful time. And I think you have to start somewhere. What I'm talking about are repeating patterns that we have seen over and over and over again. And it is my job to shed light on these patterns so that we can stop. So if you want to do the work, and I truly believe that everyone marching wants to do the work to end oppression, that means you have to listen to what the people who are being oppressed are saying that they need and the patterns that they're seeing. You're not going to see it if people don't say it.
But you're not going to be there to say it.
No, and that's where I have said it,
yeah.
Right? But I also know this, that if I said I was going to go and speak, my name would be used to coerce other women of color, just as I got an email saying so-and-so will be there, so-and-so is going to be there, to also work for free. I have to set an example for other women of color who are similarly pressured to do this work uncompensated. I don't ever want my name to be used as a reason why another woman undervalues her work.
I've known you a little while, Ijeoma, so I hope I can ask this at the risk of offense. Is it possible that you're carrying a grudge that we've explored many times? Again, not a grudge that we've explored, but a feeling that white Seattle liberals have not been awake, alert, active, done enough. Is it time to, and if so, is it time to bury the hatchet and join hands? Because what you're saying can come across as divisive, even if it's heartfelt. Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, and I do think that that's something that a lot of people, when they initially hear my words, will feel. I recognize there will be that sting that comes on, right? Because it feels like your intentions are being attacked. But the truth is that what is divisive is when we ask marginalized populations to stifle their needs and stifle their complaints to benefit, quote unquote, the bigger whole. We have to stick to our ideals. And if our ideals are true inclusiveness, that includes listening and learning from past mistakes and moving forward in a productive way, not just a peaceful way, but a way that actually makes change and builds upon what has already been done and corrects mistakes that have been made in the past.
So to a listener who wonders whether Ijeoma is talking about her or him, you would say if you're marching on Saturday with your friends and then not doing anything else, I'm talking to you?
Exactly. There are a lot of things that we can be doing right now in Seattle to make a real difference for the lives that you say you are marching for. So I say, take this. If you go, get inspired and then say, where can I be of use? Don't think that marching down the street is going to change anything. What it should be is an act of inspiration to make you get out there and leverage your privilege, leverage your relationships, and get out in the streets, find out what's happening in this city. We have a new youth jail coming up. Look at whether or not you want black and brown children locked up disproportionately in this city in a brand new facility. And really start putting this to work. Meet with your school boards. Do whatever you can on a local level to put that inspiration from this march to work.
Ijeoma Oluo, Seattle writer, activist, the editor-at-large of The Establishment. Tomorrow's march, Be There or Not, begins at 10 o'clock at Judkins Park. Thanks, Ijeoma.
Thank you.
It's KUOW's The Record. President-elect Donald Trump has promised a near-immediate repeal of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Since Trump was nominated, there's been a surge of Americans signing up for the ACA, and at least one poll shows the law having its highest approval rating ever. But some people who depend on insurance cannot wait for Obamacare to be gone. Nansen Moline lives in Seaview on the Washington coast. She voted for Trump because he promised to repeal and replace the ACA. She says her coverage has shot up in price and plummeted in quality.
I had been overseas visiting a daughter who gave birth, my first grandchild. I came back to a stack of mail for the previous month that I had been gone just before the election, and included in that mail was my renewal for my health insurance plan. I'm going through, I open that up, and I broke into tears, cried, had a fit. Made a phone call to confirm to the insurance company. They said I would no longer see any of my doctors, any of my caregivers that I've seen for years. I pulled out my ballot right away. I had been agonizing what to do, considering going third party, and I marked the ballot for Trump because I knew he was going to repeal Obamacare.
Now, you're not on the state's health exchange, right? You're not using Obamacare?
That's correct.
So why do you blame Obamacare for your higher rates?
Because basically the whole system is imploding. Premiums are exploding. I pay over $1,000 a month for my health insurance, and I have not the highest deductible. I have like a $3,000 deductible. But more than that, no matter what I pay, I no longer had a choice. Because of all of the changes Obamacare ushered in, I no longer had a choice of who was in my network. I live on a border community right at Oregon's border, and my doctors, my cardiologists, my specialists, I need to travel across the river to see people who I can actually get in to see. If I did qualify for the exchange, none of those exchange plans would allow me to see any of my providers. My neighbors have to drive 2 hours to Olympia just to see doctors now.
So the state health exchange was not a good option for you, or are you saying, who told you that your rates, your rates were raised by the existence of this state health care exchange under Obamacare?
Well, who told me? It's just common sense. Premiums are exploding. Insurance companies are pulling out of the market. And with all of these changes, what's happened is it directly impacted me so that I couldn't even see my own doctors.
Now, the Republicans, as you know, Nansen, are struggling over this question of, well, if we're going to repeal the Affordable Care Act, how are we going to replace it? What are the parts of the Affordable Care Act that you hope the Trump administration and Congress keep?
Well, I would like to see them keep some form of dealing with pre-existing conditions.
How would you feel if insurance companies still have to give you coverage despite your pre-existing condition, but in order to make a profit from that, they're allowed to double your rates?
It is true. It's not going to be perfect, and we're going to have to make it work. I don't want to see anybody have the rug pulled out from under them with their current coverage. But I do think we need to have a well-thought-out replacement.
Well, that's what Republicans are struggling with right now. They're disagreeing over how to replace the Affordable Care Act without really disappointing, angering the people who use it. Are you concerned that they don't have that plan that does all those things?
No, I have confidence that it's going to get worked out.
Well, one thing was the president-elect's promise recently that it was going to be insurance for everybody, which some people wondered, insurance for everybody, is that single-payer government health care? I mean, did you take it that way?
I did take it that way, and I was confused because I don't think it means what he thinks it means.
Do you mind him, the idea that, our incoming president might be confused about one of his signature campaign promises to repeal and replace?
Okay, let's just be frank here. I think his tweets are confused about a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
I have confidence in Congress. Congress is going to be the one, and it's going to have to be a bipartisan effort to hammer out this situation. But we do need to start with one, repealing it, and then replacing it.
And if the Republicans replace the Affordable Care Act and your health coverage doesn't improve, your rates don't improve the way you hope, would you regret your vote for Trump? You said you were not a Trumper at first.
I believe in the people he has coming in to work with him. I believe in the Congress. And I just know that they're working really hard. And I believe and I have confidence that once we put the free market in place, and yes, I think insurance companies have, you know, they've been trying to survive. Have I liked the way the rates have gone up? Absolutely not. But I just think anything that is less regulation and more common sense is better. Change is not going to happen overnight. This is going to take years down the road in order to get this all ironed out.
Well, Nansen Moline, can we call you down the road and see how health care is working out for you under our new president and Republican Congress?
So you're trying to see if I'm going to have egg on my face.
Well, hopefully for you, you'll have just what you want.
You know, it's making sausage is kind of ugly, and I think there's going to be heartburn. I do have heartburn sometimes and wonder if my vote was correct, but I have faith and I have confidence that we're going to solve these problems.
Trump voter from Seaview, Washington, Nansen Moline, with high hopes for the president-elect's repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act. You're listening to KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. When Marsha Linehan was a teenager, she thought people were after her. She cut herself, and she tried to kill herself. Her family and doctors didn't know how to treat her, so she was hospitalized at 17. She describes that time as hell. But while she was in hell, she made a promise to herself.
I said, I will get out of hell, and then I will go back to hell and get other people out. Huh. And that particular promise in my life has more than any single other thing driven my entire life.
That promise to get other people out of hell, of wanting to kill themselves and of going through failed treatments, that promise eventually brought Marsha Linehan to the University of Washington as a therapist and researcher.
I decided that I wanted to treat the highest risk, most difficult to treat patients.
Where did you find them?
I called down to the hospital and I said, listen, do you have any really difficult to treat patients who are highly suicidal? If you have any, would you send them to me? You know, and of course, I immediately had huge numbers of patients. And so they were the subjects in my research to start with.
And you had an idea how you wanted to treat people.
Yeah.
It didn't really work out. Will you tell us
the
story?
It was a disaster.
A disaster.
I was a behavior therapist. I still am a behavior therapist. But at that time, behavior therapy has a focus on helping people change the pattern of their behavior so that they have better outcomes. Okay? This is basically how behavior therapy works. So I figured this is, you know, going to be easy and I'll just cure everybody and then I'll go do something else, I think. So I started that. It was a disaster. The first thing that happens, the patient said, what? You're saying it's me? You're saying I'm the problem? I said, no, I'm not saying that. So I went back to my team. I said, okay, we've got to come up with something else. I thought, well, probably we need to have an acceptance-based treatment. You know, one where we're really understanding, we really accept them. They're all right the way they are, all that kind of stuff. So I started doing that. So I'm doing that. And the next thing that happened was, what? You're not going to help me? I thought you were going to help me. I said, oh, no, I'm going to help you. So then that's when I realized, wait a second, hold the phone. I can't do change and I can't do acceptance. So I realized that I had to figure out a way to bring those two together.
And this is what's become dialectical behavior therapy, DBT.
DBT.
So the dialectical part, you've got these two
opposites
in conversation, acceptance and change.
Yes.
How does DBT work? How do you bring those together
so
in this landmark way?
Yeah. So DBT has many components to it. One of the components is teaching skills. And when patients come in, then you're working at helping them make the changes that need to be made, but accepting that which does not have to change. It also...
What would be an example of that?
An example where I have to work out how what they want makes sense and what I want makes sense. So, for example, I once had a client who was highly suicidal. And so she comes to me and says, I have to go to the hospital. Okay, now this was probably the fourth time she would have gone to the hospital. There's no real evidence that putting people in hospitals keeps people alive, and I knew that. And I also viewed her going to the hospitals, her being reinforced, you know, that she could get suicidal and I would send her to a hospital where she got a lot of care and attention. Mm. So I didn't want that. So she kept saying, I want to go to the hospital, and screaming and hitting things and stuff. And I kept saying, no, you don't need to go to a hospital. You don't need to go to a hospital. And meanwhile, I'm saying to myself, find the consensus in my mind.
You find know, the consensus.
Find how she's right and you're right. Mm. Find the middle here. Find it. So finally, I realized by talking to her that both of us wanted exactly the same thing, which is she wanted to live and thought that if she didn't go to the hospital, she would die. And I wanted her to live thinking that if she went to the hospital, she would die. So we had to come up with something that met both of our needs, which meant me talking her into going to a medical part of the hospital. I said, you know, putting you back into...
Not a psychiatric ward.
Out of a psychiatric ward, where she would go. And of course, what would happen when she went often is the people in the hospital would call me and I would say, you know, please don't reinforce her. Don't treat her like a child. And they say, you mean we shouldn't be sitting on the floor with her, helping her peel her fruit? I said, right, don't do that. She's an adult. Do not be sitting on the floor playing games with her. So in other words, it was me seeing her point of view and her seeing my point of view and us both finding the same thing by me going her way and her going my way.
I'm talking with Marsha Linehan, director of the University of Washington's Behavioral Research and Therapy Clinic. So the listener hears about acceptance and change.
Yeah.
I think our listeners might be able to understand how someone feels in a terrible situation, dealing with trauma, et cetera, how they, with help, might change. But what's the acceptance part? How could someone accept what to them is unacceptable?
Let me be 100% clear to you. If you don't accept things, you can't change them. Okay? So just think about it for a moment. So this is where radical acceptance comes in, which is a key part of the treatment. Okay?
Radical acceptance.
Radical acceptance, which means complete and total acceptance of that what is. You have to radically accept in order to make changes, in order to get somewhere. So let's take the woman who's being beaten by her boyfriend, okay? So how many women will get that stopped if they don't ever radically accept it's actually happening? Take the person who goes to get their car fixed. They get their tires fixed. Then they leave, and about 2 hours later, their car's not working again, so they take it back. Now, who do you think would fix it faster? The person who radically accepts and, in fact, something's still wrong with the car, even though they just fixed it? Or the person who says, what are you talking about? He just fixed it. You must have done something wrong. So who's going to fix it? It's the person who radically accepts that something's wrong with the car.
So you're saying that a lot of us tend to argue with reality.
Yeah, exactly.
So a patient says, where in my life am I struggling against reality instead of saying, okay,
it boils
this is
down
what it
to
is.
Radical acceptance is simply saying that which is. Now, the other thing you're saying is not that it's okay. You're saying all behavior is caused. The teenagers all get this really fast, which is everything that's going on is caused. And if you want to change things, you have to change the causes. That's the key to the whole thing. So then you have to, but if you don't accept the cause, how are you going to get it fixed? If the guy at the car thing didn't accept that there was a problem with it, how's he ever going to fix it?
What's an example of accepting the cause in the life of a suicidal person?
The life of a suicidal person.
Who wasn't person. Accepting a cause. What do you mean?
Well, the average suicidal person, this has been my experience, the average suicidal person, is they actually believe they're going to be better off dead. Now, I almost always point out to them there's zero data for that. And in fact, there are a bunch of religions who think that if you kill yourself, you're going to be worse off. And what if that were true? So it really doesn't make any sense to kill yourself. But the trick for being suicidal is to figure out, how can I build a life that I will experience is worth living? And that's the whole focus of DBT. It's not to tell a person what to do or give them their goals, but it's to figure out what has to happen for you to believe that your life is worth living. And then how can we make that happen?
You have been studying suffering and acceptance in the human mind, and you keep expanding the application of your work again and again and outward and outward. What do you want us to take away? Listeners who are not struggling with suicidal thoughts or mental illness, but what do you want listeners to take away from what you have learned? What can we learn?
Well, if you don't have a mental disorder, you're in great shape. We'll start with that. Secondly, though, everybody in the world needs the skills. I use the skills. My whole team uses the skills. Everybody I've taught the skills to use the skills.
I should disclose, I know something about this, and I use these skills.
Yeah, we all do. Everybody does. Everybody who learns the skills uses them because they're really extraordinarily effective. And, interpersonal skills are effective. Radical acceptance effective. Mindfulness effective. All these things. So everybody can use those. You don't need to have a mental disorder. And I'm very interested in going, to prisons to teach people there the skills. Because, a lot of people are where they are in terrible shape only because they didn't learn skills. No one taught it to them. And so, the more that we can, if I had to get anything out to the public, it'd be the skills. Because the skills we know transform people. The other thing that matters is how you treat other people. So you may not be suicidal yourself, but you may know other people are suicidal. And the most, probably if I had to say, what's the most important thing if you know someone else who's suicidal, is to not expect that they'll thank you right away. It's almost impossible when you're in hell to say thank you. But that doesn't mean that what you're doing isn't helpful. Don't stop because they don't say thank you. And what you want to be is understanding and caring of the other person. And if I had to say, how did I get out of hell? It was largely from priests. When I went to church, being kind to me, it was a professor being kind to me. It was all these people who helped me. If no one had helped me, if no one had cared about me, I probably wouldn't be here. I had all the nuns who cared about me. And the real problem is that when you're in terrible trouble, and other people caring for you, it's almost impossible to communicate to them. When you're very distressed, when you're crying, when you're upset, when you wish you were dead, when you are miserable, it is very hard to communicate to the other person that they've helped you. But they have helped you. And it's important to know that you can't ask the person you're helping to communicate to you that you actually have helped them. So that's really critical.
Marsha Linehan created dialectical behavior therapy, and that treatment just won the Grawemeyer Award, which recognizes ideas that substantially impact the field of psychology. And she's in Seattle. She's director of the University of Washington's Behavioral Research and Therapy Clinic. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. I hope you'll get your podcast of The Record, Week in Review, Speakers Forum, wherever you get your podcasts. Maybe KUOW.org.